Welcome back to the Travel Trade Exchange podcast. This has been a while since I've posted anything. I guess my last posting was with Dan Edwards, and I hope you enjoyed that. Hope you listened to it. I've been trying to redesign my website. I didn't like the layout of the design, and so finally I put together a new website. The old website is gone. The new website is basically just starting under construction, but the podcasts are the same. I am having a problem. One of the issues I have is I'm doing my podcast through a feed burner, and it doesn't give me very good statistics on who's downloading and where they're downloading. And the audio files are being stored at my server, and I'm trying to move them to Libsyn. So if anybody has any expertise on how to move my feeds from FeedBurner to Libsyn and then get that in iTunes, I'd sure love some help. I'm not a technology wizard, and the most I can do is put together a bare basics website. Anyway, this week I have one other thing. I want to encourage you to join my email list, and with that I'll just let you know. You won't get very many emails from me because I don't write very much and I don't enjoy writing. But I've got an email sign-up, and if you sign up for the emails, you'll just be notified of new podcasts or videos as I put them together. Now, I will have a video section on my new website, and I'll be posting some videos from time to time, and they'll be on YouTube as well, but at least there will be a link from one to the other. But this week I've got Spike Hampson. Spike Hampson is a associate professor in geography at the University of Utah. He teaches most of his courses online, and that gives him freedom to travel because it doesn't matter where he's at, he can still teach his courses. He talks about his travels in his little boat, and I'm going to break this interview up into two podcasts because it went a little long, and I don't think most people are willing to devote more than a half an hour at a time to most podcasts. So I'm going to break this interview up into two separate podcasts. But I'll let you tell his story, but some very interesting adventures he's had. He built a small boat, an 18-foot river boat, and has been moving that boat all the way from Wyoming, and it sits right now in the Turks and Caicos Islands. He's got a lot of other stories to tell, and I'm going to have him back as often as he'll come back. And he may choose to actually send me some MP3 files, and I'll just post the stories that he tells by himself right at our website. And I'd encourage you as well, if you're interested, to just email me your own MP3 files, and I will post those as well. Today's January 22nd. I'm in Salt Lake City. The weather is hazy and cold in the valley, and clear and wonderful and brilliant up in the mountains. Great time to be skiing. So with that out of the way, let's listen to what Spike has to say. Thanks. This is Franz. I'm with Spike Hampson. Spike is an adventurer that I met at the University of Utah. He teaches up at the University of Utah in the Department of Geography. But he lives a very geographic life. You've been all over. Spike, you've been to the Caucasus, you've been to the Far East, you've sailed in the South Pacific. And the story I like is the one of you building a boat, and so far you've taken it down the river. So tell me that story. That's a good one to start out with.
Well, it's hard to figure out a start for that story, but actually, yes, I built a riverboat, 20-foot inboard powered jet-driven riverboat. I didn't really know what I was doing. I ordered some plans from this company in California, Glen L. Marine. They have simple boat plans for home builders, not for yacht builders, but for people who are handy with tools. So they have simple, basic designs, generally pretty seaworthy, not extremely beautiful but in most cases, but serviceable boats. And I picked out this riverboat because I had this idea in my head that maybe I could build a boat and go through both North and South America. That was the thing that got me motivated about this, was the prospect of taking a boat through both of those continents. And so I worked out a route, and I got all excited about the route, and that motivated me to buy the plans, and undertake the construction. Building the boat took me 4 years, basically. Built it in Park City area, where there's a lot of snow in the winter. I built it outside. I had cover overhead. I had to build a deck under which I could build the boat. So, but I didn't have any protection from the cold. So in the wintertime, I didn't get that much done on it, but I would spring, summer, fall, I'd work pretty steadily on it, but slowly. But this was back in the late 90s and 2000 to, let's say, I guess 98 to 2002 was the time period when I was building the boat. It wasn't actually the first boat I built. I built a sailing catamaran in the Hawaiian Islands back in the 70s, and that was, frankly, the most wonderful experience of my life, I have to say. I was so pleased to have constructed that boat, and then I used it to learn to sail in the Hawaiian Islands. And I had always intended that I would build a bigger one, use it to sail around the world, just never got to it. And so this riverboat thing was something that came along in my mind later on when I realized that decades had gone by and I had given up on my original dream, and I shouldn't have. And so I was trying to retrieve something from all of this. So that's what got all this started. So anyway, the boat turned out wonderfully. Of course, anybody who builds their own boat thinks it's wonderful, but it is wonderful. I love this doggone thing. In spite of the fact that it's a real dog. I mean, it's got all kinds of problems. I get engine problems. I can't go to windward. I can't punch into things at all. And, you know, it's really unsuited for lots of conditions, especially the conditions I'm in right now. Because right now it's out in the Caribbean, in the Turks and Caicos Islands, and I'm trying to get to windward, trying to get out to the east and then veer south to get down to Venezuela. I'm basically island hopping, and the task is to find calm enough days that I can make a crossing from one island to the next without getting beaten up too badly. So the boat's not really intended for that. It's designed for rivers and lakes, and most of the trip is that. So started in Wyoming and went across the country and out the St. Lawrence and then down the whole eastern seaboard. But most of the eastern seaboard, I was able to stay in protected waters in the intercoastal waterway, not around Nova Scotia, not down the New England coast, but after that. So it's been a wonderful trip. I've been at it so far for 8 years and doing 2, 3, 4 months each year, basically. The objective is to get to South America and follow a sequence of rivers that would take me through the continent south to Buenos Aires. Now, when I started this whole project, I had in my mind that from the time I left Wyoming until I got to Buenos Aires, maybe we're talking, you know, a year and a half, something like this. And I was giving myself plenty of time, I thought. But I quickly realized, no, that's not the way it is. But it's actually better this way because it doesn't really matter where I am. It's just such a great excitement because it's always some new place that I've never been before. And even if you've been a place before, if you haven't been there on a boat, it's a different place. It's just a totally different world when you approach someplace from the water. And that's especially the case, for example, going down the Missouri. You know, I've driven back and forth across the country many, many times. And getting across the Great Plains, it has its... it's inspirational in one respect, but in other respects, it's rather boring. Crossing all that open, empty prairie. But when you're on the river... No, it's not prairie. It's all, you know, you've got cottonwoods all the time. You've got, you're usually down in a little valley. It's much more interesting. And so the Missouri route across the Great Plains was a great experience. Plus, it has a whole series of reservoirs, which most people don't realize are there, but they're huge things. They're comparable to Lake Powell in size in many instances, you know. So you've got a lot of lake boating as well.
How would you get around the reservoirs?
That was one of my biggest concerns when I started out. And that's one of the interesting things about a project like this is you know, on the one hand, if you think too much about it, I will get to your question in a second, but you think too much about it and you'll never solve all the problems, you know, so you have to kind of just go on good faith, right? But you do try to anticipate all the kinds of problems you have, and then you end up worrying about some that you haven't figured out a solution to. This was the one I worried about, and it was the least of problems. I got the boat... I got the boat to a location in Montana on the Yellowstone River, and I had had been shuttling between my truck and trailer and the boat. So I would take the boat down the river, then I had to get it past a weir. So I then hitchhiked back up my truck and trailer and came and found a place to haul the boat out, put it in on the other side of the weir. And I did this twice and finally got the boat down to, I can't remember the name of the town of Montana, but it was on the Missouri, on the Yellowstone River. And I thought, well, now I know when I get over there in North Dakota, there's going to be a dam to get around, and I know there are going to be five more after that. So I'm just going to have to do the same thing. I'm going to have to hitchhike back to where the truck is stored, get the truck and trailer, drive out and do this, and then find a place to store the truck and trailer. And this didn't bother me. I thought, this will work. I'll manage it this way. But what actually happened is that it was never a problem at all getting around the dams, because people are always curious. What are you doing? You know, and I say, well, I'm just going down the river. And they say, well, how are you going to get around the dam? And I say, well, I haven't figured that out yet. And I say, well, I got a truck. I'll haul you around. And sure enough, you know, three occasions I had people just haul me around who were just standing beside the dock where I came into a marina, and they just did it for me. And so I never had any kind of problem at all getting around these dams.
So the kindness of strangers then, huh?
I cannot tell you how much this changed my attitude about Americans. I mean, I am thoroughly American in many respects, and I love my culture. But I did have this mentality, this attitude that, you know, all these people in the rest of the world, lots of them are a lot nicer and a lot more generous and a lot kinder than they are maybe in America. But no, it's not true. When I went down the river, everywhere I went, people would go out of their way to do things for me. Of course, it was in rural areas. I don't know. It's not really. I don't know if there's a difference between city and country, but it was all rural America, basically, that I was dealing with. But everywhere I went, people were really, really good to me, and I became much more respectful of just how nice a country this is. I don't want to sound like patriotism. I just mean the people are nice, and they're so friendly and helpful. I had people do things for me all the time. You know, I can't even begin to identify things, but you know, I remember one place I went into, and it was a marina, and it was closed. There was nobody there, and so I thought, well, I'll sneak in and I'll just park for the night. This is on the Missouri. So I parked the boat, and I'm walking around trying to find out if there's anything I have to worry about. And then this guy yells at me and asks, wants to know what I'm doing, and I tell him, and I say, well, I'm just hoping I could park the boat. And he says, ah, sure, tie it off, and come on up and have dinner with us. And so I go up, and, you know, I'm having dinner with this family of total strangers, and they've got a friend in, and they, this was in the spring, and they had just taken a trip across country about 30 or 40 or 50 miles to some place to get what they thought was the best corn that could be gotten. And they were just eating corn for dinner. And so we sat there and ate cobs of corn. Well, they had a few other things as well, but basically it was about the corn. And it just sticks in my mind because this friend of theirs, who was a massive guy, he ate something like 15 ears of corn. You know, I got through three, and I thought I was really overdoing it. But it was just a relaxed approach to life that I hadn't realized was quite as widespread as it is.
Were you always by yourself?
Almost always. I actually tried to get started in the fall of 2004. And now fall is the wrong time to try to start a boat trip on a river in the West. And I knew that. But the problem was that I had finished the boat in 2002. The whole objective was to get on this trip, and one problem after another had gotten in the way of my getting started. And in the spring of 2004, I had planned to go, but then my parents needed help. They were retired and in Arizona and wanted to move to a new location. I'm an only child, and I really needed to go and help them. And that ended up taking up the whole summer. And so I was into September before I was really free of obligations, family obligations. And I thought, I can't wait any longer. Damn it, I'm just going to go. I don't care. I'm going to get the boat up there and try it out. And so I got the boat up to this Bighorn River in Wyoming, and now we're talking about
high water now, right?
Oh, this is really, really low water.
Oh, really?
It's fall.
Oh, it's fall. Okay.
Right, it's October. It's okay. The end of the season. So actually, it was a guy who does local shows here named Chad Booth who helped me haul a boat up here. He does recreation shows of one sort or another, and he did a small video of the whole experience. But he helped me get the boat up there, which is a story in itself. I had all kinds of problems getting that boat into location. Trailer breaking down, and I can't begin to explain it all. But he took me up, and we found this place to launch in the Bighorn River, and I got
not a regular launch ramp or anything.
No,
like
this
that.
Is just a little dirt track that went down to the river that seemed to be nobody was around, so we figured we could put it in. And so I got the boat in, and no sooner was the boat in the water than it was grounded. It was so shallow.
Now, what does your boat draw?
1 foot.
1 foot. Okay, so it was shallower than a foot.
It was shallow. I thought this was basically impossible. I figured I got no problem. I got a 1 foot draft. I got nothing that sticks down because it's a jet drive. So I thought, you know, I've got it beat. There's no way I can't float this river. I was wrong. This river was so skinny that I spent a week on that river, during which time I did not cover more than 10 miles. I spent hours every day pushing myself off of sandbars and rock berms and trying to get maneuvered, which was often very difficult because, in fact, the current was pretty strong. And so once the boat got lodged on a sandbar or anything, getting it off was against the current. And so I would have to put out anchors and try to winch in on the anchors and tie off to trees and haul and shove one end of the boat, then shove the other end of the boat. It was really...
And you're doing this all by yourself?
I'm doing it by myself. Yeah, that was the question, right? I'm sorry about that. So that whole first season, yes, I had... that fall, I had no one with me, and I spent a week, made very little progress, and finally accepted defeat. It had turned cold. It was threatening to snow. The water was freezing. I didn't have to worry about hypothermia because I was working so hard, but basically I was in the water wading around most of the time. Anyway, I got the boat out of the water, and that in itself was quite an event because it would involve these two Wyoming characters who were just, one of them, I'd parked the boat beside his land, and they're pretty protective about their land up there, and you can't touch shore next to somebody's land in Wyoming. You know, you can stay on the water, but you can't touch shore.
So it's considered a navigable river, but you don't have
that's right.
Don't have rights to the shore then.
But this guy, he was very nice to me, and he helped me. And he had a neighbor who was upset about my being on the river. And he and his neighbor had an ongoing war. I mean, they just fought between each other all the time. They just for fun, I think. You know, I think it was just their temperaments, their nature. You know, whatever one wanted, the other one didn't. And so finally, I had reached this place. He had helped me. He said, yeah, I'll help you get someone over here to get the boat out. And I know a place where we can pull it out. And I said, well, where's that? And he said, well, just up the river back about 150 yards, there's a place. And I said, oh, is that your land? And he said, no, it belongs to my neighbor. I said, well, what is he going to think about this? And he said, oh, we won't tell him. Oh, don't worry. So, we get up there, and it's just this mud wallow. It's impossible to me to believe that it's going to be possible to get a trailer in there and haul my boat out, which is really a pretty heavy runabout, you know, as it's loaded down with all kinds of stuff, as you can imagine. But we get these guys to come out from the nearest town, and I guess it was Thermopolis, and we have a trailer, and they're trying to get in position, and it turns out that the neighbor has a little runabout tied up in there, chained away. And so the guy who's helping me, who's got the land just downstream, he says, ah, that's no problem. We'll just cut the chain. And so, see, he goes, cuts the chain and moves this aluminum boat, and we work for about an hour and a half and finally manage somehow to get this boat out of the water on a trailer that was way too small for it, and just a single-axle trailer, and I got the boat stored for the winter. So
up there in Wyoming?
Up
then?
There in Wyoming. So I had failed in the first attempt.
So, but these people were all helping you just out of the good kindness of their hearts?
Yeah, they're just, yes. Well, not the guys who brought the trailer.
Okay.
We hired them.
Okay.
Right? But this guy, whose land I had parked on, he was very, very helpful and very nice. So anyway, I left the boat over the winter there, and I knew that in the spring water levels would be better, be a better chance to get going. So in the spring of 05 is when all of this started. But I was nervous because of the experience that fall. I'd really struggled, and I was kind of anxious about, can I get this to happen? So I actually got a friend at the university, a professor in political science named Dan McCool, who was willing to go with me to get started. And so in the spring of 05, he and I went up there at the appropriate time, got the boat launched, and started down the river. And things went much more smoothly. And over the course of 4 days, we covered some, I don't know, maybe 150 miles or so, more or less got to the Montana border. And then Dan left, went back to the university, and I carried on alone from there on. So there was that one time for 4 days when Dan was with me, and then the following season, I never was anyone with me. The third year, yes, I had a friend on board a couple days and that sort of thing, but usually alone.
So the first real season was really your second season out. Correct. Then. So we started in Wyoming and went through Montana. How far did you get that year?
That when I got started and things went ahead, I got up the Bighorn to where it joins the Missouri, or the Yellowstone, followed the Yellowstone up to its junction with the Missouri, and then took the Missouri down to the Mississippi, up the Mississippi and then into the Illinois and through Chicago into Lake Michigan, and then I followed the east coast of the lake, or the shore of Michigan State, and went up that shore to, what was the name of the town?
Holland?
No, further north.
Grand Rapids?
Yeah, near. Yeah,
Benton Harbor.
No, Grand Rapids.
Grand Rapids,
and
okay.
I stored the boat there at the end of the first season. So I had figured by then I'd be down in Florida or something, but, you know, that was as far as I got. But what I learned is that this is just great. First of all, I expected this to be the worst part of the trip. That is the least interesting.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't. It was exciting. It was fun. I had just a great time, and it was beautiful everywhere I went. I really liked the landscapes and the towns, and, you know, it's just a really lovely trip. And so I was really excited about this, so I didn't care that it was taking a long time.
Now, when you're working your way down the rivers before you got to the Great Lakes, would you just tie up along the side, tie to a tree? How would you anchor at night?
Yeah, I would. I just pull over the side of the river and find a little eddy or some place where it was not too rambunctious, and tie off to a tree or pull on shore or what have you. My boat is really basically pretty
light then, I mean, in the water, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, it's we're talking a couple thousand pounds, you know.
Okay.
So it's not exactly a runabout, and it's a handful for one person to push around. But you can beach it as long as you haven't got any obstructions and push it off again. And just, you know, if you just nudge up to shore and take a line to shore, that's all I needed to do. If it got beat up on the bottom, I'd deal with that the next season, you know. So, yeah, it was fine that way. And, yes, I would just tie off any old place. Didn't stay in any marinas or anything except to one in Omaha, Nebraska. Otherwise, no. Until I got to Lake Michigan, then it's a different story, right?
You have to stay in marinas.
I had to stay in marinas then, because basically getting off the lake is kind of a problem. There are relatively few places to do it, and most of the places you can do it are towns and pretty busy. And even there, I managed to find places that were not marinas, because one of the great advantages of the boat is it's so small that
you can hide.
You can just hide it somewhere. You just stick it somewhere, and it's fine. It only needs a foot of water, so lots of times you can put it behind the dock instead of tied to the dock, you know. So it's been nice that way. But no, that's first season. It was basically just tying off at nearest location. I had one funny incident at the first reservoir, which is Sakakawea, in North Dakota. It's about a 90-mile, 100-mile long reservoir. And I worked my way down this reservoir to the downstream end where the dam is, and there was a marina there, which is a typical pattern. Typically, the marina is going to be somewhere near where the dam is. And I did stay in the marina there. I forgot about that. And then the next day, someone hauled me around the dam, put me in downstream, and I merrily went on my way and traveled that day for a few hours because I hadn't gotten transferred until, you know, midday or maybe one in the afternoon. So I carried on for 2 or 3 or 4 hours. Then I tied off at the side of the river next to this town, and the town was maybe 4 miles away, but I carry a bike on board so I could always bike to any place I wanted
to go. Is this the famous Bike Friday?
It is. And okay. That's the reason I got the Bike Friday, was okay. to have on the boat. So I tied off and took the bike out and pedaled off and wandered around this little town, and then returned, got on the boat, and night came, and I made something to eat and went to bed. And about, 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, I'm sleeping, and all of a sudden, the boat just, clunk, it tips over on its side about 30 to 40 degrees and bumps. And I, what in the world is going on? And I get up and look around, and I'm up on a rock pile. I'm completely out of the water. The water is at least 10, 15 feet away. And I'm sitting on this gentle slope that has small rocks and boulders.
Were you just drifting down the river at night?
No, I was tied.
I was tied
off at the side of the shore. Well, tied is not right. I had my anchor out and just stuck it in the ground out there. Right?
Okay.
But now I'm completely out of the water.
Well, had your anchor dragged?
No. Turns out that they let water out of the dam on a regular sequence in such a fashion to generate more power during certain hours of the day and less power at other hours. And I had arrived at a time when relatively little water was being...
the water was being
allowed through, and now there wasn't much water being passing through the dam, and so...
So the river had dropped then.
The river dropped a good, 4 feet, something like that, I'd say, right? Wow. And so when I got up in the morning, I said, oh my God, what am I going to do? How am I going to get this boat in the water? So I spent a couple hours working at this, and I discovered that this rock pile actually was just a bed of rocks, and underneath the rocks it was kind of a mucky, sandy stuff, and the rocks were superficial. And so I thought, well, the boat is sideways to the river. It's maybe 10 feet away. I'm just going to pull all the rocks and pull them over to the side. So I spent an hour just pulling rocks, and because they were all small enough so I could lift them and handle them. And I was creating a sort of muddy way. And I thought, once I get that done, then I'm going to go search around for some branches or something that I can lever the boat up onto and then see if I can skid it down to the water, right? So I've been working at this for about 2 hours, and this guy comes along. He's driving up on the highway, and he stops. And he says, you don't have to do that. The water's going to be coming back up in a few more hours. I said, oh, so...
So that's how you discovered that there was the reservoir.
That's right.
Okay.
So I thought, okay, great. So I took my bike and went to town. Came back, and sure enough, the boat was floating, and I took off and headed downstream.
Did you have to worry that? Were you worried about that from there on
yes.
out?
Yes, so
you,
I was.
You always made sure you had plenty of depth then, huh?
Yeah. I realized then that especially near the dams, you get a lot of variation in the river level. Right. Once you're maybe 20, 30 miles further away from the dam, then it's not so noticeable. You still get a fluctuation, but at that point I didn't have a read on it. I didn't have any sense, you know. But there is a definite variation in the river level most everywhere because these dams do generate power, and the power is needed certain times a day more than others.
Right? Do you have any specific, you have a lot of memories, and they probably all jumble together.
Oh, they are. It's terrible.
But does anything in that stretch of the river down to where it joined up with the Illinois, does any particular story stick out in your mind?
Oh, yes. There's one that's classic to me.
Really?
Yeah. When I came into this, it was actually before this problem of getting around that dam, was Lake Sakakawea. Let me take a break here for a second.
Okay.
So you were asking me what is vivid in my mind from this trip, and there's one incident in particular that I remember. And generally, the great thing about going on these rivers is, you know, I could lose the boat, but I didn't think there was much risk to me, because basically I can swim, and the river's not that big, and it's not that wild, and so, you know, I could do things wrong, and I could lose the boat, and that was a constant worry, but I wasn't really concerned about myself. So I get on the Yellowstone, and the Yellowstone joins the Missouri more or less on the border between North Dakota and Montana, which is really out in the middle of nowhere. This is the end of the world, basically. It's just short grass prairie, and it's actually the boom area for oil production these days, Williston,
okay,
North Dakota. But just downstream on the Missouri, just east of where that junction is, maybe 20 miles, the river, the Missouri, begins to flow into this big reservoir called Sacagawea, which is Sacagawea, the Indian woman, but they have their own distinct spelling for it. Now, people don't realize it, but this river is one devil to deal with because it is absolutely brown. You cannot see anything in it. So if you put your hand in the water, 1 inch below the surface, you won't see any of your hand, nothing. So for someone who's a novice trying to read this river, it's very, very difficult because you can't see anything below the surface. You only have the surface appearance of the water to give you any kind of cues or hints or anything. And the river is it's characterized by a narrow, relatively deep channel with broad areas to either side that are very, very shallow. And this narrow channel weaves and wanders back and forth within the riverbed unpredictably. And if you're not in the channel, you're likely to be grounded, even with my boat, even in the spring. And this was happening to me. I got into the Missouri, and it was my first experience with it. And I was following it, but as I approached this Sacagawea, this big reservoir, actually, what happens is that the flow of the river is now beginning to slow as it enters into that reservoir. And because it's slowing, it's depositing material everywhere. And so you've got no hazards to speak of. It's all just sand, right? But it's everywhere, and it's very shallow, and you don't know where the channel is. And so I spent 3 or 4 hours going along at a very slow pace, by which I mean maybe 2 to 3 miles an hour. Hardly any faster than the current. The current was flowing about 2 to 3 miles an hour. And I was just barely surpassing the speed of the current because I was afraid of running aground. Not because I thought I'd damage the boat, but just because it's a lot of work getting it off. When I run it aground, then I have to get out and basically hump the bow of the boat with my shoulders to get it released. I'm doing this, and I'm running aground regularly, by which I mean perhaps once every 15, 20 minutes. Right? So 2 or 3 or 4 times an hour, I'm trying to get. Yeah, you're looking at.
I'm pulling up the. Yeah, there we go.
Reservoir. And we're talking about this area right over in here.
All right, we're looking at Google Earth, and I'm just looking at the visuals of what Spike's talking about. So yeah, look at that. That's all shallow through there, isn't it?
Yeah, now that part of the lake is actually reasonably,
right here.
This is not too much of a challenge. This is all deep enough.
But here is where you're talking about,
yes,
right? Yes,
that's where I'm talking about, from up in there out to here.
Okay. So from Williston out to basically the entrance.
I think this was taken late in the season because basically when I was there, this was all water. But that's the channel.
Okay. Right? Oh, all right.
And so the trouble is trying to find that doggone channel and stay in it.
So for our listeners, we're looking at a visual of Google Earth, and what Spike is talking about shows up as green grass right now, but that apparently was all underwater when you were there.
Yeah,
okay.
Because it was earlier in the season. It was we're talking about May right now.
Okay.
Right? So, and actually, this is where the story happened. I'm coming down here. I'm running aground all the time. And I come around here, and I can see that now it's beginning to open. And it looks like I'm in the reservoir, and it looks still. And I have just spent the last 2 hours pushing off of groundings. And I had gotten into a routine. The routine is that, you know, I'd go gently, and as soon as I'd hit something, I'd shut down the engine, run to the back, jump over the side, and then trot up to the bow. Because with the 1 foot draft, that meant the water was only coming up to my knees or so. And so I had a routine down. I come around this corner, and all of a sudden, what I see in front of me, actually, is all across what appears to be the start of the reservoir proper, there appears to be a forest of dead trees. Runs from one side to the other. It's just the stumps of trees sticking up through the water. This is quite common on these reservoirs. They don't bother to take the trees down. They just die, and then you have them sticking up maybe 10, 15, 20 feet out of the water. And it's a rather sinister sight, actually. But I saw this, and I looked, and I throttled back, looked around. I couldn't find any place to get past these trees. It looked like they were everywhere, from one side of the reservoir over to the other. But I knew there had to be a channel somewhere. And I could see where the edge of the trees that I could see, the edge of the forest where I could see it, it looked like it was an arcing initiation line. And the trees were curved around a bend, it appeared. And so I thought, well, maybe the channel is just this side of where all the trees start, and I should just follow the trees fairly closely and to stay in the channel, right? Because I couldn't see any other, and I said, maybe I just can't see where the channel turns the other way because it's too distant. And so I adopted that as a strategy. But now the wind is blowing from behind me at a pretty good pace, you know, not terribly strong, maybe 10 miles an hour or something, but there's a breeze. It's not like you often have inland. There was a breeze, and it was from behind me over my left shoulder. Right? And so I'm following this route that I've selected as being most probable for the channel, and I go aground, right? And so without thinking, I go to, you know, shut down the engine, go to the back, jump over the side, and when I do, I go right up to my neck. Now, fortunately, I had my hand on the carling, and I was in muck. I was in mud. And I was covered in muck from my waist down to my toes. And from my waist up to my neck, I was in the water. And
wow.
If I hadn't been holding onto the carling, actually, I don't think I ever would have gotten out of this. But I just happened to be holding the carling. So I was able to pull myself back up, and I got myself into the boat. And when I got into the boat, I was just covered in mud, right? And I cleaned myself up as best I could, and I cleaned up the boat as best I could. And then I started up the engine to see if I could back myself out of this stuff. Nothing doing. I tried the main engine, and I was just sucking muck. And it was squirting out the back, out the jet. So I tried the little outboard. I have an outboard. I let it down and tried motoring with that. But it wouldn't push me. So the boat was stuck in this muck. And neither engine would move me out of it.
And you can't push yourself out.
And I can't push myself out because there's no solid surface on which to stand to push. I think, what am I going to do? Now, it's a beautiful day. In spite of the wind, it's perfectly clear. There are hardly any clouds. It's late in the afternoon, early evening, and I'm sitting around. So I just clean up. And one thing that's nice about doing this trip is time is not a big issue. So I just sort of sat down and thought about things for a while. I said, well, what should I do? And after thinking about this for an hour or so, I thought, you know, I guess first thing I should do is I should let somebody know I'm here. So I thought, is there a way I can do that? And I had a cell phone, and I got out the phone, and sure enough, I had one bar. And so I had a friend back in Utah, and I thought, I'll call him and let him know I'm here. So if nobody hears from me for a couple of days, then he'll do something about it. And so I called him, and he answered the phone, and I talked to him for a few minutes, explained what had happened to me, and I said, I'll figure out a way sooner or later, but I don't know what I'm going to do right now. But everything is fine. The boat's fine. Nothing's damaged. I'm not damaged, but I'm stuck in the mud and can't move. And he said, well, you probably should let somebody local know as well if you can. And so that preyed on me, and I finally, after I hung up, I thought, yeah, I guess he's right. So I tracked down a number for the county sheriff, called the sheriff's office, and said, look, I don't need help. I'm fine and I'm happy, but I want you to know that I'm out here stuck in Lake Sakakawea. That's such and such a location up its upstream end and in muck. And I'm about a quarter of a mile from shore, but I can't figure out at present how to move. But I'm sure I will. But I just want you to know I'm here. Well,
that wasn't good enough for them. You know, they got to rescue me. This is their thinking. Right? And so we had this ongoing discussion for about a half an hour about them coming out to rescue me and my resisting. And I say, no, I really don't want to be rescued. I'm fine. I can, you know, I'll call you in a day or two if I'm still in terrible shape. I just called to let you know I'm here, right? But they were very, very persistent. And finally, I caved.
The most exciting thing that's happened to them all week.
Yeah, well, that's only part of the story. So they say, we'll be out there in, I don't know, 45 minutes or an hour or something. I can't remember what the time was, but something fairly reasonable, an hour maybe. And I said, okay, well, thank you very much. Well, it's now about 8 or 9 at night, because this is May, early before June, but, you know, it's a really long day, so it doesn't get dark until 9:30 or so. So it's the end of day, but it's still beautiful out there, and I'm sitting and waiting for them. And I hear a noise in the distance, and finally they show up, and it's three guys in orange jumpsuits on one of these airplane boats. You know the type
of...
Oh,
yeah, huh? Yeah, right? Swamp boat, sort of.
A swamp boat. Now, the deal is they just bought this thing. So they are very eager to try it out. Right?
Okay. That's why they wanted to rescue
they,
you.
That's why they wanted to rescue me, because they wanted to use this boat. Right?
Justify the new toy they just
that's
bought.
That's exactly right. So they come out, and this thing is making a huge amount of noise, as you can imagine. And all three of the guys are wearing these
earmuffs.
Earmuffs.
Yeah.
And they reach me, and it's obvious that they're not boaters. Right. I mean, they're okay. It's just a runabout, but they don't really.
They don't know how to.
They
deal
don't
with
know
boats.
A lot about boating.
Yeah.
So I don't know a lot either. But since even I could tell they don't know a lot about boating, they clearly didn't, right? So they said, well, here, what we'll do is, we can't drag you, we can't tow you, because you see, there's no place to tie on the back of the boat. They don't have.
Yeah, with that, where would you tie on to it?
There's nothing to tie
right.
to. Right? So they said, well, we'll tie side by side. And I thought, well, I'm not sure that'll work. I think, you know, it'll probably just go around in circles. And they said, well, we'll give it a try. And I said, okay. So we tried that. And indeed, we
went around in circles.
And okay. That didn't work. So it had to be a direct pull. So then they said, well, look, this has got a scow-type bow. It's dead, you know, it's a...
You're going to push it now, huh?
Well, no. They want to run a line from the bow underneath the boat and pull
okay.
me from the bow. And I said, well, if you think you can keep that line under the bow of the boat. And they said, yeah, we think we can do it. And they wanted to try that. And I said, okay, well, we can give that a try. Thank
sure.
you. And so so they gave me the end of a line, and they asked me to tie it off. And so I tied to the cleat up on my deck in front of the windshield. And ran it through the chuck up at the bow where the anchor line would go. And the fellow who's in charge on the boat says, no, don't tie it there. He says, tie it down below. Tie it on your eye where you pull boat out of the water, because that's much stronger. And I said, well, yeah, but then I can't get at it. I can't reach there, you know, but if it's up on the bow, I can deal with it. And he said, yeah, but it's not going to be strong enough on the bow. And he was very insistent. And I argued with him for a few minutes, but I finally came to the conclusion that, you know, they're rescuing me. I really kind of have to cooperate, don't I? So I said, okay. So I tied it to the eye down below where you pull a boat out of the water. Right. So it's now out of reach for me. I can't get to it. Right? So then these guys organize themselves, and it's now twilight. It's now getting gray light. And they're starting to organize to motor away from me to pull me. And I realize that they have given me a line that's on a drum that's got 500 feet of line. And it's this, you know, polyethylene or the floating stuff, mm-hmm. just floating on the water. And the guy who's tending the line, he's pulling it off this drum and just throwing it in the water. Just, you know... All of this line, I mean, hundreds of feet of it. And so we got all this loose line lying in the water. The wind is carrying it all downstream or downwind, which is actually into the trees, which are only about 40 feet away. Right? And sure enough, it gets in amongst the trees just at the time when they decide they're going to pull me. And so they start to pull forward, and it pulls the front of my boat immediately to the right and draws me right into those trees. So I'm now tugged right into the trees, and I'm snugged up against one. I got another one up near my the stern of the boat, and I have no idea what the depth is like underneath this. And so they come back when they see this disaster. Of course, I'm yelling at them as soon as this all starts to happen, but they can't hear a thing.
Right.
And they can hardly see anymore because it's getting so dark. So finally they come back and they say, well, we can't do any more tonight, but just hop aboard and we'll come back and sort it out tomorrow. And I said, no, I'm not leaving my boat. I'm staying here overnight. And we had this long discussion about this for a while, but finally they caved and they said, okay, well, we'll be back as soon as it's dawn tomorrow. We'll be back to tow you out. And incidentally, if you could, try to retrieve this line, because they had it all over in the water, and it was all over the place. So I said, okay, very good. I'll do what I can. And so the arrangement was they were going to return in the morning.
So that's the end of the first episode of the two-episode interview with Spike Hampson and some of his adventures. If you have a chance, check out the website. It's a work in progress. I'm open for suggestions. I'm probably going to have a video section as well as a photograph section. And I may do some more blogging. I'm not big on writing. I'd rather talk than write. But I may do a little bit more if I have the time. This is a labor of love, not a labor of profit. So I get around to it when I get around to it. If you have some stories you'd like to tell, please give me a call or send me an email at Franz, F-R-A-N-Z, at TravelTradeExchange.com. I'd love to interview you if you have some stories to tell, or if you'd just like to email me your own stories in an MP3 format. As long as they are good stories and appropriate, I'd be glad to post them. So I will probably get the second episode of the interview with Spike up next week. Thank you for listening.